Of a sudden, the fallacy of it all bursts upon him. He can no longer live with his own external. The internal, frustrated perhaps for many lives, is gradually demanding attention because the external becomes increasingly uncomfortable. After you abuse the body long enough, it fights back. If you abuse life long enough, it turns against you. And sometimes in an emergency of that type, there is an extension of consciousness. This is the way in which most mystics interpret the conversion of St. Paul, who suddenly reversed his position because something happened whereby he was able to dominate his own ego and to transmute himself into a servant rather than being a master over outer things. He became a servant of inner things. Now, this sense of ego as in conflict with the soul causes us again to ask a little bit more about the soul. Emerson and the Neoplatonists of Alexandria and Athens were of one mind on this particular point. The soul is a transcendent being, and this transcendent being is the key to the transcendentalist concept of life. The soul is that seed of eternity which is sown in man at the time of his creation. It is the seed of the life that goes on from generation to generation. It is this seed which is transmitted from parent to child and from child to their child. All this is that life principle which is within the human being, which is not only a principle of vitality, but which has locked within it the laws of its own proper existence. This realization makes it possible for the individual to assume correctly that there is within himself a transcendent being, a being that is his own true self. Paul says, "The Christ in you, which is the hope of glory." The soul, in a sense, is the Christ in you, the divine power without which you couldn't exist at all, but which you never or seldom, if ever, understand correctly. This internal thing is the thing that gives you life, but most people use it to perpetuate death. This inner power, therefore, must be cultivated, and it is cultivated by the idea of storing up treasures in heaven. Heaven, in this case, being the inner life. The Greeks, Plotinus and Proclus, point out very clearly that the soul within the individual is the power not only to lead the life into the correct paths, but the power also to appreciate that which is good outside of self. The individual is not only having an enemy inside himself, his own appetites, but he has an enemy outside of himself, his ignorance and misinterpretation of his world. The individual who measures his world only in what it has done for him or to him is wrong. The individual who takes it for granted that life is impossible and that it is his moral duty to criticize and condemn has simply missed the entire principle. So man, looking around him, is deceived by his environment, and looking within him can be deceived by his appetites. To overcome this and to rationalize this situation properly, there must be an opportunity for the individual to experience the sublimity of the good. Actually, all great works of beauty in nature have been done by the soul. This is the soul that has inspired the great art, the great music, the great literature. It is the soul that has made great humanitarians. It has given us the martyrs and the saints. It is the soul in the individual that doeth the works that are important and right and proper. The soul locked in the average individual, therefore, is at a disadvantage because it does not know how to cope with these problems. So the Neoplatonists said, instead of simply trying to go to the temple and pray for something, go around and look and see the temple in the world around you. See beauty in its own place in nature. It is more important, perhaps, to stand by the side of a beautiful valley and look out upon the wonders of life and realize how beautiful nature really can be. The beauties of nature help us to appreciate and understand the large plan of things. As we look upon a beautiful scene, we realize that the Creator of all things put together a universe which is beautiful simply because it is correct and is doing exactly what it is supposed to do, and man is not quite so beautiful because he is not doing what he is supposed to do. And in doing the wrong thing, he has disfigured himself. Nature, therefore, according to Plotinus, tells us to love the beautiful, and that wherever nobility or beauty exists, the soul moves towards it. Now, this is very important because the great religious realities of life have been given to us in terms of beauty. The great cathedral is an architectural masterpiece, a magnificence of stone and stained glass, a wonderful thing. And when you come into it, you are quiet because the very wonder of it impresses you. A great painting is a wonderful experience. And a painting, as the Zen masters in Japan pointed out, a painting is not just a thing. A painting is alive. For nothing that is not alive can influence anything else. So it is the life in the picture, taken in by your soul power, that helps you to grow. The same is true of a great book or a great piece of music. It is equally true of a very simple person in whom you can see the virtues and values that you are not able to possess yourself. All things that are beautiful draw from life and draw your own soul out from the lockedness of itself. Beauty releases soul power, and it brings into play what Emerson calls the overself. It is the power to bring forth out of yourself sublimity. Beauty may cause you to break into tears because you cannot handle its emotional pressures. It may cause you a great exaltation or may cause you a great depression because you're not able to handle it. But beauty is an instrument for the release of soul power. And beauty is not only in things but in qualities. Love is beautiful. Hate is ugly. Beautiful ideals and emotions. Kindness is beautiful. Forgiveness is beautiful. All the things which arise from the impulses to be better or to share good, all these things are beautiful. And yet, many of the most beautiful things in the world are the commonest. There is nothing possibly more beautiful in all the world than the leaves of a weed or some ordinary thing. For there is nothing that does not ultimately reveal the soul power working through material nature. And it is our own soul power working through human nature that must gradually grow if we ever hope for peace, security, or integrity in this tired and rather confused world. The transcendentalists, therefore, were cultivating and much more interested in the beautiful. They wanted to live simply. They realized that the more you have, the more trouble you have. Thoreau worked that all out to his own satisfaction at Walden Pond. He knew the beauty of gentleness. He wasn't able to live it always. Emerson wasn't able to live it always. No one is completely free from the pressures which restrict the integrities. There is no one is completely perfect. But everyone is trying to take the next step forward. If you try to make a big leap, you're liable to fall down. But a little step you can take every day will gradually give release to the soul power. In other words, it's what the alchemist said or meant when he said it will open the door of the shut palace of the king. It is the opening of the inner life, allowing it to come out. When you're not afraid to be yourself, when you're not afraid that you will be misunderstood, as long as you are playing games with your own mind, you will be misunderstood. But when you are truly gentle, have great faith, and the kindness of your soul comes through in its full value. You know when to speak and when to be silent. You know what to say and why it should be said. And you are not involved in any effort to avenge yourself, revenge yourself, or dominate the thinking of another person. Everything moves in a very quiet way. And it is this path of the quiet way which is true mysticism. Mysticism is not something that you get by all kinds of fancy doctrines. It is not something that you rationalize or intellectualize. Mysticism is simply allowing the best of yourself to govern the rest. And when this happens, then you are truly a transcendentalist. You are a person in whom the spiritual values of life have gradually been released into their own maturity. Also, of course, it is rather obvious that if we believe in life after death, it is the degree of growth that we have achieved that we take with us. It is this degree of growth also, the peace that we have here, comes to be the peace that we have in the life beyond. The early saints of the church were very much concerned with this thought. They believed that as this world is a terror to the ignorant, so life beyond the grave will be a terror to the ignorant when they die. But if the individual here has learned to love life, serve other people, be gentle, kind, and thoughtful, he will awaken beyond the grave in a world of peace and quietude, because it is his own life. The afterlife is merely an expression of his own life here while he is trying to grow. Now, in the effort to grow, people get all mixed up. As natural, because for some unknown reason, the last several hundred years, growth has been seriously retarded. Probably the cause for it all is karma. Because many entities have been coming in here in the last 100 years that were involved in the tragedies of the previous 2,000 years. Man did not grow easily, or generously, or happily. He grew through wars and privations and pestilence and catastrophe, and he grew by constantly serving his own selfish purposes. Here we have it today. Today, as never perhaps before in the recorded history of the world, success is the only thing that counts. And the only success is in this world. The only success is to have that extra house now, the yacht, the swimming pool. These are success. And for these, the individual is perfectly willing to compromise his integrities. And you ask him why, and he says, well, why shouldn't I? Everyone else does. This is where the individual, however, is mistaken. What everyone else does has no actual influence upon him unless he permits it to. The thing that counts with each individual is to retain his own integrities. And there's never been a better opportunity than right now to retain them, because they are slipping away very fast. Yet it is this very slipping away that in the last 25 years has caused the greatest resurgence in religion, I guess, in the last 1,000 years. More and more people are realizing that something is wrong. More and more people are having trouble living with their own way of life. And in government we find constant anxiety at these points in our history. The great rebellion that is arising against nuclear armament and all these things bear witness to the fact that the soul is still there and is trying to speak. It is determined to accomplish certain things. The human being is potentially better than his way of life today will permit. But he cannot depend upon the changing of society to improve himself. Everyone has said that in a better world he could live better, and that if we were in heaven already, we'd be perfect. Unfortunately, it isn't true. The better world is of no value to us unless we are able to live in it constructively. If the better world would simply become a way where we could have more and do less, we would be worse off than we are now. Work is becoming an odious thing, so we are meeting it with every kind of a mechanical device we can think of. And all these things are going to turn on us. Because our motives are wrong, our intentions are not correct as far as personal character is concerned, we are looking for laziness rather than growth. We are looking to save money by unemploying people. we are also looking for shortcuts to almost every kind of material advantage we can think of. Our crime weight is high, our narcotics addiction is high, our alcoholism is high. All of these things bear witness to the fact that the individual is refusing to permit his own soul to function. Nature's correction of this is that whatever we do that is against the right that we should be doing will ultimately come back and hit us. We are going to gradually find that the only peace in the world is to keep the rules, and that the keeping of rules means that friendship, kindness, and cooperation must become the basis of human relationships. We cannot be a competitive people and survive. We cannot break the faith without the faith damaging us. And all of our attitudes affect not only the soul within us, but the body. Because, as the ancients pointed out, the healthy body is made possible by the constructive qualities of the soul. A soul that is enlightened can protect the body from a great many sorrows. It won't prevent it from passing on gradually as is its way. But the soul controlling the body gives us the maximum health and longevity. And the soul dominating the mind makes us constructive, cheerful, and kind. And the control of the soul over the emotions makes us loving, affectionate, friendly, and moderate in all appetites. All these things help to make a person. It is this blocking of the soul that gives us religious intolerance. It breaks homes. It leaves parents and children isolated. It does all the things we do not want to have happen. And wherever we break the soul's laws, we suffer and we are sad. We weep. We realize that something is desperately wrong. There is no pleasure left in life for us because all our affairs go badly. But people do not realize, apparently, that this is all due to the fact that we have declared war upon the best of ourselves. We are determined to destroy that which prevents us from doing what we please. And as that which we want to destroy is the only indestructible part of ourselves, that we come in the end to a stalemate. The Neoplatonists of Alexandria discovered in the works of Plato the idea of a great religious system. We are told by Proclus of Athens, who was the last of the Platonic successors, that Plato's philosophy was the outer cover for a religion. And therefore, Proclus, in his books on the theology of Plato, lets us know that in the closing years of his life, Plato transformed his whole philosophy into a way of life, a very simple way, that the end of philosophy is that the individual shall experience the divinity of life, that philosophy is not an end but a means, and that the end of all philosophy is that man shall love the beautiful, serve the good, and honor the integrities of existence. That philosophy gives us our first basic understanding of the true nature of God. And that by philosophy we can justify the correction of our own imperfections. We can find a natural theology, a theology that is supported by natural law, that is obvious in the world wherever we look around us. It is the actual integrity by which every function of existence is maintained. The Alexandrian Neoplatonists took this concept and began to interpret again philosophy in terms of a great internal discipline, an experience of universal integrities. Philosophy was not destroyed by this. Mysticism does not destroy as a philosophy. It consummates it as far as philosophy itself is honorable. Philosophy shows us many of the truths which help us to have the courage to go out and live well. But to end in an argument concerning abstractions is to destroy the essential value of philosophy. Philosophy is not a mere intellectualism. It is not something in which the individual trying desperately to be wise fails in all of his values of life. Philosophy is simply the outer chamber of a great universal system. It is one of the outside steps leading into a temple. Philosophy is therefore perhaps summed up in man's discovery that all things are reasonable, all things are just, and all things move inevitably to the fulfillment of their ordainment by divinity. So this concept of a philosophical theology, in which the individual grew rather than received absolution vicariously, this philosophy that became Neoplatonism and later so influenced Emerson and the school in Concord, Mass., was simply a realization that there was a natural way of doing things that is not spectacular, that is not full of fads, that does not require the individual to viciously attack things that do not seem to work out to his particular satisfaction, but a philosophy that is natural, kindly, good-natured, and peaceful. It is said on one occasion that Emerson, in an effort to prove his democracy, so to say, after all, he was the great American Brahmin, very much tradition-bound, but he thought that as a great evidence that he should have the maid and the servant in the house eat with the family at meals as a sign of the recognition of democracy. After about three or four times of this experience, the maid and the housekeeper asked to be relieved of this responsibility, as they had much more pleasure eating quietly by themselves and not becoming involved too much in family affairs. But apparently Emerson got the message. He realized, therefore, that his effort was wrong. He had tried to make a symbolic example of something, but he had not sensed the realities of life. He learned more from the fact that they didn't want to eat at the table than in anything else that he could have gained in the form of satisfaction for his statement of democracy. Things have to be what they are, but everything is what it is and can be beautiful. There is no reason why any truth should hurt anybody. The only person it can hurt is the person who doesn't believe in truth. But, on the other hand, to go around making cruel remarks against other people, this isn't a matter of truth. This is always ulteriorly motivated. There is spite, there is vengeance, there is some type of ulterior motive whenever we are unkind. We're trying to get some kind of satisfaction. We are trying to fulfill something in ourselves at the expense of other people. Neoplatonism and mysticism do not work on this particular level or in this type of thinking. Now, we have hundreds and hundreds of groups coming, springing up now on all kinds of religious principles. Some of them are very good. Some of them are maybe good. And some of them are obviously not good. But they are all based upon some concept of something. All of them, finally, to fulfill a constructive purpose, must come back to the same rules. No system can grow or help other people to grow unless it helps the individual to correct his own mistakes. Unless he is impelled to be a better person, no organization can make him one. No organization can save him by taking him out of the thundering herd and isolating him on the top of a mountain. No divine plan can be fulfilled through the use of narcotics. All these various shortcuts, all these various original ideas, some of them are the result of metaphysical speculation. Some of them probably have psychic activity. But any system that does not make the basic requirement, the requirement of self-improvement, and self-improvement in this case not becoming wiser in worldly things, but becoming better in the virtues of life. No system that does not teach the individual to escape from the pressure of his own attitudes can do anything of very permanent value. We have to break through the shell we have built, the shell of our own infallibility, the shell of our own uniqueness, the shell that we have been picked out by destiny for some noble purpose. All these attitudes must be gradually overcome. It is only when we overcome these things and become what we ought to be, natural human beings, that that nature or the infinite can use us for some major purpose or project. Those who have done the most for the world have been those who have forgotten themselves and their own spirituality and tried to work every day for the benefit of the people. We also must expect no rewards. The reward is not in anything except growth. The final reward for the good deed is growth. We become better people. And because we are better people, we can do more for others. The whole problem of growth, therefore, is one of it being self-rewarding or self-fulfilling. We grow and in so doing become a little wiser, a little better, a little more beautiful within ourselves. Actually, according to the Greeks and the Egyptians, the human soul is the link between spirit and body. It represents the middle distance between the exterior world and the internal. Through the soul, the eternal moves into the temporal. Through the soul, the divine root of life becomes a tree and spreads downward to become the mortal world in which we live. All things are in their middle distances, soul. That is why everything in its natural state is beautiful. The stars are beautiful, the sky is beautiful, the earth is beautiful. They are all symbols of a beauty which is normalcy, order, integrity, and justice. The soul, therefore, links man's spiritual and material life. In alchemy, it is the transforming and transmuting agency. It is that power by means of which it is possible for the human being to transcend himself. It is his link with the infinite. It is that part of his own nature which alone can survive, which alone can fulfill, and alone can solve all the problems of existence, and solve them by the simple realization that there are no problems except the ones he creates himself. So man living in a beautiful universe has a right to enjoy it. He has a right to share in it and be part of it and live with it. He has a right to have the natural joys of life. But he also has the problem to realize that any pleasure that is detrimental to his own nature or damaging to any other person cannot be a true source of comfort or consolation. The individual cannot be selfish and grow. He cannot nurse his own temperament and outgrow it. On the other hand, people have tried for years to fight against themselves. And very often this is a terrible fight. It is a fight against shadows. It is a tremendous resistance against demons of formless or mindless structure. To fight against this selfishness does not seem to do any good. The individual simply becomes more and more neurotic. He always wanted to do something. He disciplines himself by not doing it, and he gets sick. Therefore, he cannot intellectually and willfully dominate his own personality any more than he can dominate his world. The only answer lies not in this fight against that which is not right, but the quiet acceptance of that which is right. Instead of opposing evil, we strengthen good. And then when we strengthen good, we discover that evil is only a shadow. It is only a not being, which we have mistaken for a reality because it had within it certain values which we liked, but which had no permanent place in the universal policy of things. If we begin to grow, the evil slips away. We no longer wish that which is not good, once we have really discovered the importance of being right in things. Now the problem of the release of the soul is in a sense an experience which Plotinus in Alexandria and Proclus both mentioned. It is a moment, maybe, only a moment, as we find it mentioned in Havelock Ellis' Dance of Life. It is an instant in which the tremendous nature of the internal is made known to us. And every effort to describe it has been futile. No one can describe in words that which is a divine fact. In those moments, the individual, in a few seconds, can have an experience that changes his whole life. It is an experience, the first contact we have with the infinite. It is a sudden awareness of the divinity within ourselves. And that divinity comes in great quietude, great gentleness, and eternal peace. It is not approaching in glory or in power or authority or majesty. It is suddenly the experience of the infinite love that governs all things, the divine power of eternal right, and the realization that all the sufferings and problems we go through are necessary because through them and through them alone can we discover this ultimate right, this power that is much more potent than anything we know. From the moment of that experience, as Plotinus tells us, there can be no doubt about anything that is good. There can be no deviation from the path of righteousness. There can be no temptation, because there is nothing left in man to tempt. He has achieved that which is all, and he will no longer settle for some partial success in some minor detail. The actual experience is the same thing as we find in the Oriental system, or we find in the writings of the various early Christian saints. This ecstasis, this momentary participation, this oneness at 1 month with the eternal. It only lasts a few seconds, and then we're back again in the old world we were in before. But that which comes back into that world can never be the same. There is something now that is entirely different. Temptations don't exist, because no temptation can exist when the individual becomes aware of the totality of available good. There is nothing he needs anymore, because he has fulfilled his own greatest need, and that is the realization of the presence of God within himself. Little by little, therefore, these Neoplatonists work toward helping themselves and each other to finally submerge their own identities in the divine love. And they did not create a great system of temples or shrines. They did not even become an acknowledged faith in the world. They simply became a way of growing that anyone can take that wants to, anywhere. It cannot be theologized. It cannot be organized. It cannot be sold. And it cannot be bought. It is a simple experience of releasing through the simple daily deeds of life, that grandeur which is locked within everything. Just as the flower passes from the bud to full bloom and then has its seed, so the soul unfolding comes to full glory and then bears its eternal fruit in the redemption of man. This type of thinking seemingly is more or less needed right now. A great many people probably aren't going to get it right away, but more are reaching for it than ever before. They are no longer so much interested in sects and creeds. They are no longer so much interested in the old traditional forms of worship. But they have a great need, a great spiritual need of the immediate presence of God. They need to have an experience of some kind that forever destroys or overcomes or eliminates or completely dissolves the insecurities of life, that the individual then lives also in an eternal life. One moment of enlightenment and the individual becomes eternal. Not because he'll be in the body all the time, but because that moment reveals to him the eternality of himself. He is an undying, immutable, inevitable being. He always has been, and he always will be. And when he knows this firmly, it makes no difference whether he is born or dies. The eternal continuity of life preserved forever in the love of God. That all forms are manifestations of a great system of spiritual enlightenment and education. We are so blessed by the plan as it is that we can ask no better. The only difficulty is we have to discover the blessing. We have to realize that the thing as it is right, and that the only way we can change it still more and make it more right is by being right ourselves. And as we grow and master the problems of existence, we are never expected to face the same problem twice. Once we have had victory over a problem, it ceases. When we have a victory over materiality, it ceases. When we have a victory over the wilderness in ourselves, we have victory, and we have escape and defense at the same time. We are free of that which we do well, and slave to that which we do not do well. Therefore, it is our constant duty and responsibility to learn more and more to do everything well that we possibly can. And in a very quiet, peaceful, and gentle way, to go along growing as nature would have us grow. This is a very special day, as it comes in each year, Mother's Day, and it is part of the great program of realization that all relationships in life are symbolic of soul relation. From the beginning of time, man has worshipped the principle of the Divine Mother. Every religion has had among its most principal deities a great feminine power. Isis, Mary, all of these different doctrines worship the principle of life-giving, not only because the mother has been given the right to become the parent of generations, but because in the very act of motherhood, probably more than in any other act in the world today, the woman has the experience of the soul. She has a moment of tremendous release of natural love, enough protection, of gentleness, of dedication, of self-sacrifice. And the moment of birth is therefore one of the great mysteries of life, and comes perhaps among the natural functions of life the nearest to the revelation of soul power. In other words, the mother principle is, in a sense, the soul principle itself. And in almost all religions, the soul has been symbolized as feminine. The psyche, although the soul, is a feminine deity. And all in the religions of the world, it is the mother of mysteries. It is the great goddess of the Ephesians. Everywhere, it is always a symbol of the soul power, because it is peculiarly manifested in the experience of motherhood. So that on this day we feel it's perfectly wonderful and right to honor the mothers of the world, and to also encourage them to the greater fulfillment of the wonder that is in their keeping, and that their own destiny is largely influenced by this. And in the law of reincarnation, the alternation of sexes means, in the end, all souls have the double experience of fatherhood and motherhood. And together this becomes a parenthood, which is the parenthood of the soul over the body, and the parenthood of God, or the divine power, over the soul and the body. All this was part of an ancient belief, but it's a wonderful belief, and it is much happier and more cheerful than many of the beliefs that we have today. In other words, happy Mother's Day to all those. And if you have already come into maturity and have children growing up around you, be grateful. And find in them a wonderful opportunity for the development of your own soul potential. And fathers, don't leave them out. They're in the picture too. They may have to wait till next embodiment, however, to go through it. In the meantime, thank you very much.